Hi, everyone. I'm Emily Omier, your host, and my day job is helping companies position themselves in the cloud native ecosystem so that their product's value is obvious to end users. I started this podcast because organizations embark on the cloud native journey for business reasons, but in general, the industry doesn't talk about them. Instead, we talk a lot about technical reasons. I'm hoping that with this podcast, we can focus more on the business goals and business motivations that lead organizations to adopt cloud native and Kubernetes. I hope you'll join me. Welcome to the Business of Cloud Native. I'm your host, Emily Omier, and today I'm chatting with Paul Ingalls. Paul, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Could you just introduce yourself? Where do you work? What do you do? And include sort of some specifics, like we all have a job title, but it doesn't always reflect like what our actual day-to-day is.
I am the CTO at a company called RVU in London. We run a couple of kind of reasonably biggish price comparison kind of aggregator type sites. So we help consumers figure out and compare prices on broadband products, mobile phones, energy. So in the UK, energy is something which is provided through a bunch of different private companies. So you've got a fair amount of choice on that kind of thing. So we try to make it easier and simpler for people to make better decisions on the kind of household choices that they have. I've been there for about 10 years, so I've had a few different roles. So as CTO now, I sit on the exec team and try to kind of help inform the kind of business and technology strategy. But I've come through a bunch of teams. So I've worked on some of the early energy price comparison stuff, some data infrastructure work a while ago, and then some kind of underlying like kind of DevOps type automation and Kubernetes work a couple of years ago.
So when you get into work in the morning, what types of things are usually on your plate?
I keep a journal. I use bullet journaling quite extensively. So I try to track everything that I've got to keep on top of. Generally, what I would try to do each day is catch up with anybody that I specifically need to follow up with. So I've got at the start of the week, I make a list of every day. And then I also keep a separate column for just general priorities. So things that are like particularly important for the week, themes of work going on, like technology changes or things that we're trying to launch, etc. And then I'll kind of prioritize speaking to people based on those things. So I'll try and make sure that I'm focusing on the most important thing. I do kind of weekly meeting with the team. So we have a few directors that look after different aspects of the business. And so we do a weekly meeting to just kind of run through everything that's going on, sharing the problems. So we use the 3 P's model. So sharing progress, problems, and plans. And we use that to try and kind of steer on what we do. And we also look at some other kind of like team health metrics. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, actually. Like, I think when I switched from being working in one of the teams to being in the CTO role, things changed quite substantially. The kind of list of things that I had to kind of care about increased hugely to the point where like it far exceeded how much time I had to spend on anything. So nowadays I find that I'm much more likely to kind of, you know, for some things to drop off. And so, you know, it's unfortunate and you can't please everybody. So you just have to kind of say like, I'm really sorry, but it's, you know, this thing is not high on the list of priorities. So I can't spend any time on it this week, but you know, if it's still a problem in a couple of weeks time, then we'll come back to it. But yeah, it can vary quite a lot.
Interesting. I might ask you more questions about that later. For now, let's sort of dive into the cloud native journey. What made RVU decide that containerization was a good idea and that Kubernetes was a good idea? What were the motivations and who was pushing for it?
That's a really good question. So I got involved about 10 years ago. So I worked for a kind of search marketing kind of startup that was in London called Forward Internet Group. And they acquired Uswitch in 2010. And prior to working at Forward, I'd worked as a consultant at ThoughtWorks in London. So I'd spent a lot of time working in banks on continuous delivery and things like that. And so when Uswitch came along, there were a few issues around the software release process. Although there was a ton of automation, it was still quite slow to actually get releases out. We were only doing a release every fortnight. And we also had a few issues with the scalability of data. So it was a kind of monolithic Windows, Microsoft stack. So there was, you know, SQL Server databases and .NET app servers and things like that. And our traffic can be quite spiky. So when companies are in the news or there's kind of policy changes and things like that, we would suddenly get an increase in traffic, and the Microsoft solution would just generally kind of fall apart as soon as we hit some kind of threshold. So I got involved partly to kind of try and improve some of the automation and release practices, because at the search startup, you know, we were releasing experiments every couple of hours even. And so we wanted to try and take a bit of that ethos over to Uswitch, and also to try and solve some of the data scalability and system scalability problems. And when we got started doing that, a lot of it was, you know, so that was in the kind of early heyday of AWS. So this was about 2008 that I was at the search startup, and we were used to using EC2 to try and spin up Hadoop clusters and a few other bits and pieces that we were kind of playing around with. And when we acquired Uswitch, we felt like it was quickest for us to just create a different environment, stick it under the load balancer, so, you know, so end users wouldn't realize that some request was being served off of the AWS infrastructure instead, and then just kind of gradually go from there. We found that that was just the fastest way to move. So it was, I think it was interesting, and it was both a deliberate move, but it was also, I think, the degree to which we kind of followed through on it was, I don't think we'd really kind of anticipated quite how quickly we would shift everything. As I said, when Forward made the acquisition, I joined kind of summer of 2010, and myself and a colleague wrote a little two-pager on, you know, here are the kind of problems we see, here are the things that we think we could help with, and the ways that the kind of technology approach that we'd applied at Forward would kind of carry across, and what benefits we thought it would bring. Unfortunately, because Forward was a privately held business, we were relatively small but profitable. And the owner of that business was quite kind of risk-affine. He was quite keen on playing blackjack and other stuff. So he was pretty happy with talking about, you know, probabilities of success. And so we just said, we think there's a future in it if we can kind of get the wheels turning a bit better. And he was up for it. He backed us, and we just kind of took it from there. And so we replaced everything from, you know, kind of self-hosted physical infrastructure, you know, running on .NET, to all AWS hosted, running a mix of like Ruby and Clojure and other bits and pieces in about 2 years. And that's just kind of continued from there. So the move to Kubernetes was a relatively recent one. That was only within the last, I say recent, it was about 2 years ago we started kind of moving things in earnest. And you'd ask, what was the rationale for switching to Kubernetes?
Let me first ask you, when you were talking with the owner, what were the odds that you gave him for success?
That's a good question. I actually don't know. I think we always knew that there was a big impact to be had. We didn't know I don't think we knew the kind of scale of the upside. So at the time Uswitch was just about breaking even. So we didn't realize that, you know, there was an opportunity to, you know, to radically change that. I think we underestimated how long it would take to do. So I think we'd originally thought that we could replace, I think maybe most of the stuff that we needed to replace within 6 months. We had like an early prototype out within 2 weeks, 2 or 3 weeks, because we'd always placed a big emphasis on, you know, releasing early, experimenting, iterative delivery, A/B testing, you know, that kind of thing. So I think there was almost like that kind of middle term that was the harder piece. And there was definitely a point where, I don't know, I think it was this kind of classic situation of pulling on a ball of string, where it was like what we wanted to do was to focus on improving the end user experience, because our original belief was that aside from the kind of scalability issues, that the existing site just didn't solve the problem sufficiently well, that it was, you know, it needed an overhaul to simplify the journeys and simplify the process and improve experience for people. We were focusing on that, and we didn't want to get drawn into replacing a lot of the kind of back office and integration type systems, partly because there was a lot of complexity there, but also because you then have to engage with kind of QA environments and test environments and sign-offs with the various people that we integrate with. But it was, as I said, it was this kind of tugging on a ball of string, where every kind of improvement that we made in the end user experience, so we would increase, you know, conversion rate by 10%. But through doing that, we would introduce kind of downstream error in the ways that those systems would integrate. And so we gradually just ended up having to pull in slightly more and more pieces to make it work. Yeah, I don't think we ever gave like odds of success. I think we underestimated how long that middle piece would take. I don't think we really anticipated the degree of upside that we would get as a consequence. through nothing other than just making releases quicker, being able to test and move faster, and focusing on end user experience was definitely the right thing to focus on.
Do you think, though, that everybody perceived it as a risk? I'm just asking because you mentioned the blackjack. Was this a risk that could fail?
Well, I think the interesting thing about it was that we knew it was the right thing to do. So again, I think our experience as consultants at ThoughtWorks was on applying kind of continuous delivery, you know, what we would today call DevOps, applying those kind of practices to software delivery. And so, you know, we'd worked on systems where, you know, there weren't continuous integration servers and where people weren't releasing every day. And then, you know, we'd worked in environments where we were releasing every couple of hours and, you know, we were very quickly able to hone in on what worked and discard things that didn't. And so I think because we'd been able to demonstrate that success within the search business, it was, I think that carried a great deal of trust. And so when it came to talking about, you know, things we could potentially do, you know, we were totally convinced that there were things that we could improve. I think it was a combination of, like, there was a ton of potential. We knew that there was a kind of a new confluence of technologies and approaches that would, you know, that could be successful if we were able to kind of just start over. And then I think also probably a healthy degree of, like, naive, you know, probably overconfidence in what we could do, that we would just throw ourselves into it. So it was hard work, but it was, yeah, it was ultimately, you know, highly successful. So it's, you know, something I'm exceedingly proud of today.
You said something really interesting, which is that uSwitch was barely profitable. And if I understand correctly, that changed for the better. Can you talk about how this is related?
Yeah, sure. I think the interesting thing about it was that we knew that there was something we could do better, but we weren't sure what it was. And so the focus was always on, you know, being able to release as frequently as we possibly could to try and understand what that was, as well as trying to kind of, you know, just simplify and, you know, pay back some of the kind of technical debt, or trying to overcome some of the kind of artificial constraints that existed because of the, you know, technology choices that, you know, people had made perfectly decent decisions on back in the day, but, you know, platforms like AWS offered better alternatives now. So it was, we just focused on being able to deliver it iteratively and just keep focusing on, you know, continual improvement, releasing, understanding what the problems were, and then getting rid of those little kind of niggly things. There was the manager I had at Forward was this kind of super, I don't know, he just had like the perfect ethos, and he was driven. So we were a team that were focused on, you know, kind of doing daily experiments. And so we would rely on data on our spend and data on our revenue. And that would kind of come in on a daily cycle. You know, so a lot of the kind of rhythm of the team was driven off of that cycle. And so as, you know, as we could run experiments and measure their profitability, we could then inform what we would do, you know, on the day. And so we'd have a handful of like long running technology things that we were doing. And then we would also have kind of other tactical things that, you know, he would have like ideas on, you know, he would have some hypothesis of like, well, maybe this is the reason that, you know, this is happening. Let's come up with a test that we can use to try and figure out whether that's true. We would build something, you know, kind of quickly to throw it together to help us, you know, either kind of disprove it or support it. And we would put it live, see what happened, and then, you know, kind of move on to the next thing. And so I think a lot of what we wanted to do is to instill a bit of that environment in uSwitch. And so a lot of it was being able to release quickly, you know, making sure that people had good data in front of them. I mean, even tools like Google Analytics was something which we were kind of quite au fait with using, but, you know, didn't have kind of broad adoption at the time. And so, you know, we were using that to look at site behavior and what was going on and reason about what was happening. So we just tried to make sure that, you know, people were directly using that rather than, you know, just kind of making changes on a longer cycle without, you know, without data at all.
And can you describe how you were working with the business side and how you were communicating, what the sort of working relationship was like, if there was any misunderstandings on either side?
Yeah, it's a good question. So when I started at uSwitch, the kind of organizational structure was, I guess, relatively classical. So you had a kind of a pooled engineering team. So it was a monolithic system, you know, deployed onto physical infrastructure. So there was an engineering team there was an operations team, and then there were a handful of kind of people that were kind of business specific in the different markets that we operated in. So there was a couple of people that focused on like the credit card market, a couple of people that focused on energy, for example. And I used to call it the startup swarm, not the stand-up swarm, sorry. So in the morning, we would sit on our desks and you would see, you know, almost the entire office move from the different card walls that were based around the office. Although there was a high degree of interaction between the kind of business stakeholders, the engineers, designers, and other people, it always felt slightly weird that you would have almost all of the company kind of interested in almost everything that was going on. And so I think the intuition we had was that a lot of the ways that we would think about structuring software around kind of loosely coupled but highly cohesive, those same principles, you know, should or could apply to the organization itself. And so what we tried to do was to make sure that we had kind of multidisciplinary teams that had the people in them to do the work. So for the early days of the energy work, there was only a couple of us that were in it. So we had a couple of engineers, and we had a lady called Emma, who was the kind of product owner. She used to work in the product operations team. So she used to be focused on a kind of data entry from the products that different energy providers would send us. But she had the strongest insight into, you know, the kind of domain problem, what problem consumers were trying to kind of overcome, and, you know, what ways that we could react to it. And so when we got involved, she had a couple of ideas that she'd been kind of trying to get traction on that she'd been unable to. And so what we had a half day session in an office. So we took over the boardroom at the office and just said, look, we could really do with a separate space away from everybody to be able to focus on it. And we just want to prove something out for a couple of weeks. And we want to make sure that we've got, you know, space for people to focus. And so we had a half day in there. We had a conversation about like, okay, well, what's the problem? What's the kind of technical complexity of going after any of these things? And there's a few kind of nuances to, like, if you choose option A, then we have to get all of the historical information around as well as the kind of current products on market. Whereas if we choose option B, then we can simplify it down and we don't need to do all of that work and we can try and experiment with something sooner. So we wanted it to be as collaborative as possible, because we knew that, you know, the way that we would be successful is by trying to execute on ideas faster than we'd been able to before. And at the same time, we also wanted to make sure that there was a feeling of momentum, and that we were, I think there was probably a healthy degree of like kind of slight overconfidence, but we were also, you know, kind of very keen to be able to like to show off what we could do. And so we genuinely wanted to try and, you know, to try and improve the environment for people so that we could focus on solving problems quicker, trying out, you know, more experiments, being less hung up on whether it was absolutely the right thing to do, and instead just focus on, you know, testing it. So were there tensions? I think there were definitely tensions. I don't think there was tensions on the kind of, there weren't tensions so much on the technical side. We were very lucky that most of the engineers that already worked there were quite keen on doing something different. And so we would have conversations with them and just say, look, you know, we'll try everything we can to try and remove as many of the constraints that exist today. I think a lot of the, I don't know, disagreement or tension was whether or not it was the right problem to be going after. So again, the search business that we worked in was, you know, was doing a decent amount of money, you know, for the number of people that were there. And we knew that there was a problem we could fix, but we didn't know how much runway it would have. And so there was a lot of tension on whether we should be pulling people into, you know, into focusing on extending the search business, or whether we needed to focus on, you know, kind of fixing U-Switch. So there was a fair amount of back and forth about, you know, whether or not we needed to move people from one part of the business to another and that kind of thing.
Let's talk a little bit about Kubernetes and how U-Switch decided to use Kubernetes, what problem it solved, and who was behind the decision, who was really making the push.
Yeah, interesting. So I think containers were something that we'd been experimenting with for a little while. So as I think a lot of the culture was, we were quite risk-affined. So we were quite keen to be trying out new technologies. And we'd been using, you know, modern languages and platforms like Clojure for, you know, since the early days of them being available. We'd been playing around with containers for a while. And I think we knew there was something in it, but we weren't quite sure what it was. So although we were playing around with it quite early, we were quite slow to choose one platform or another. I think in the end, or in the intervening period, I guess, between when we went from, you know, the kind of more classical way of running Puppet across a bunch of EC2 instances that run, you know, a version of your application. The next step after that was switching over to using ECS, so Amazon's container service. And I guess the thing that kind of prompted a bit more curiosity into Kubernetes was that I forget the projects I was working on, but I was working on a team for a little while, and then I switched to go do something else, and I needed to create a new, you know, put a new service up. And rather than just doing the thing that I knew, I thought, well, I'll go talk to the other teams, I'll talk to some other people around the company and find out, like, you know, what's the way that I ought to be doing this today? And there was a lot of work around kind of standardizing the way that you would stand up an ECS cluster. But I think even then, it always felt like we were kind of sharing things in the wrong way. So if you were working on a team, you had to understand a great deal of Amazon to be able to make progress. And so back when I got started at uSwitch, so in, you know, when I talked about, you know, doing the work about the energy migration, you know, AWS at the time really only offered EC2 load balancers, you know, kind of firewalling, and then eventually relational databases. And so, you know, back then the amount of complexity to stand up something was relatively small. And then, you know, kind of come to a couple of years ago, you know, you had to appreciate and understand kind of routing tables, VPCs, you know, the kind of security rules that would permit traffic to flow between those. And it was one of those, it was just kind of relatively non-trivial to do something that was so core to what we needed to be able to do. And I think the thing that prompted Kubernetes was that on the kind of Kubernetes project side, we'd seen a gradual growth and evolution of the kind of concepts and abstractions and APIs that it offered. And so there was a kind of differentiation between ECS or, you know, I actually forget what CoreOS's equivalent was. I think maybe it was just called CoreOS, but like there were a few alternative offerings for running kind of containerized clustered services. And Kubernetes seemed to take a slightly different approach, that it was more focused on kind of end user abstractions, right? So you had a notion of making a deployment that would contain replicas of a container, and you would run multiple instances of your application, and then that would become a service. And, you know, you could then expose that via ingress. So there was a way that there was a language that you could use to talk about your application and your system that was available to you in the environment that you were actually using. Whereas, you know, AWS, I think, you know, would take the view that, well, we've already got these kind of building blocks, so what we want, you know, our users to do is assemble the building blocks that already exist. So you still have to understand load balancers. You still have to understand security groups. You have to understand a great deal more at a slightly lower level of abstraction. And I think the thing that seemed exciting, or that seemed the potential about Kubernetes, was that if we chose something that offered better concepts, then you could reasonably have a team that would run some kind of underlying platform and then have teams build upon that platform without having to understand a great deal about what was going on inside. They could focus on more on, you know, the kind of applications and the systems that they were hoping to build, and that would be slightly harder on the alternative. So I think at the time, again, it was one of those fortunate things where I was kind of just coming to the end of another project and was, you know, kind of in the fortunate position where I was, you know, just looking around at the various different things that we were doing as a business and what, you know, kind of what opportunity there was to do something that would help push things on. And Kubernetes was one of those things which a couple of us had, you know, had been talking about and thinking, oh, you know, maybe now is the time to give it a go. You know, there's enough stability and maturity in it. You know, we're starting to kind of hit the problems that it's designed to address. You know, maybe there's a bit more appetite to do something different. So I think we just gave it a go. We gave it a go, built a proof of concept, showed that we could run the most complex system that we had. And I think also did a couple of like early experiments on the ways in which Kubernetes had support for horizontal scaling and other things which were slightly harder to put into practice, you know, in AWS. And so we did all that. And I think gradually just kind of grew it out from there, just took the proof of concepts to other teams that were building products and services. We found a team that were struggling to keep their systems running because they were a tiny team. They only had like two or three engineers in. They had some stability problems over a weekend because the server ran out of hard disk space. And we just said, right, well, look, if you use this, we'll take on that problem. You can just focus on the application. It kind of just grew from there.
Was there anything that was a lot harder than you expected? So I'm looking for like surprises as you're adopting Kubernetes.
Oh, surprises. I think there was a non-trivial amount that we had to learn about running it. And again, I think at the point at which we'd picked it up, there was kind of early days for automation. So I think maybe Google had just launched Google Kubernetes Engine on Google Cloud. Amazon certainly hadn't even announced that, you know, their hosted Kubernetes would be an option. There was an early project within Kubernetes called COPS that you could use to create a cluster, but even then it didn't fit our kind of network topology because it wouldn't work with the VPC networking that we needed and expected within our production infrastructure. So there was definitely a lot of that kind of work in the early days where you had to, like, you know, to try and make something work, you had to understand, you know, in quite a level of detail what each component of Kubernetes was doing. As we were kind of gradually rolling it out, I think the things that were most surprising were, that for a lot of people, it solved a lot of problems that meant that they could move on. And I think people were actually slightly surprised by that, which it sounds like quite a weird turn of phrase, but I think I think people were positively surprised at the amount of stuff that they didn't have to do, you know, for solving a fair few number of problems that they had. There was a couple of teams that were doing things at a slightly larger scale that we had to spend a bit more time on improving the performance of our kind of setup. So there was a team that had a reasonably strong requirement on the latency overheads of ingress. So they wanted their application to respond within, like, I don't know, I think it was maybe 200 milliseconds or something. And we, you know, through setting up the monitoring and other bits and pieces that we had, we realized that ingress currently was doing all right, but there was a fair amount of kind of additional latency that was added at the tail that was a consequence of a couple of bugs or other things that existed in the infrastructure. So there was definitely a lot of, you know, kind of little niggly things that kind of came up as we were going. But, you know, we were always confident that we could overcome it. And I said, I think that a lot of teams saw benefit very early on. And I think the other teams that were perhaps a little bit more skeptical because, you know, they'd got their own infrastructure already. They knew how to operate it. It was, you know, kind of highly tested. They'd already run capacity and load tests on it. They were convinced that it was, you know, the most efficient thing that they could possibly run. I think even over the long run, I think they realized that there was more work that they needed to do than they should be focusing on. And so they were quite happy to ultimately switch over to the kind of shared platform and infrastructure that the cloud infrastructure team run.
As we wrap up, there's actually a question I want to go back to, which is how you were talking about the shifting priorities now that you've become CTO. Do you have any sort of examples of, like, what are the top three things that you will always care about, that you'll always have the energy to think about? And then I'm curious to have some examples of things that you can't deal with, you can't think about, the things that tend to drop off.
The top three things that I always think about. So I think actually what's interesting about being CTO that I perhaps wasn't expecting is that you're kind of ever so slightly removed from the work that you can't rely on the same kind of signals or information to be able to make a decision on things. And so, you know, when I give the kind of Kubernetes story, it's one of those, like, you know, because I'd moved from one system to another and I was, you know, starting a new project, I, you know, experienced some pain. It was like, right, okay, I've got to go do something to fix this. I've had enough. And I think the thing that I'm always paying attention to now is trying to understand where that pain is next and trying to make sure that I've got a mechanism for being able to kind of appreciate that. So I think a lot of the things I try to spend time on are things to kind of help me, you know, help me keep track of what's going on and then, you know, help me kind of make decisions off the back of it. So I think the things that I always kind of spend time on are generally things trying to kind of optimize some process or invest in automation. You know, so a good example at the moment is we're talking about starting to do canary deployments. So starting to automate, you know, the actual kind of rollout of some new release and being able to automate a comparison against the existing service, you know, looking at like latency or some kind of like transactional metrics to understand whether it's performing as well or, you know, different than something historical. So I think the things that I tend to spend time on are, you know, process oriented or are things to try and help us go quicker. One of the books that I read that changed my opinion of management was Andy Grove's High Output Management. And I forget who recommended it to me, but somebody recommended it to me and it completely altered my opinion of what value a manager can add. So one of the kind of lenses I try to apply to anything is, you know, of everything that's going on, what's the handful of things that are going to have the most impact or leverage across the organization and try and spend my time on those. I think where it gets tricky is that you have to go kind of broad and deep. So you as much as there are kind of broad things that have, you know, kind of high consequence to the organization as a whole, you also need an appreciation of what's going on in the detail. And I think that's always kind of tricky to manage. I'm sorry, I forget what was the second part of your question.
The second part was, do you have any examples of the things that you tend to not care about that presumably someone is asking you to care about and you don't?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't think it's that I don't care about it. I think there are some kind of questions that come my way that I know that I can defer, or they're things which are kind of easy to hand off. So I think that's a good question. I think one of the things that I think always tricky to prioritize are things which feel high consequence, but are potentially also very close to bike shedding. And I think that is something which is I'd be interested to hear what other people said. So a good example is like choice of tooling. And so when I was working, you know, kind of on a team or on a problem, we would focus on, you know, choosing the right tool for the job. And we would bias towards, you know, like experimenting with tools early and figuring out what worked. And I think now you have to kind of view the same things through a different lens. So there's a degree to which you also kind of incur an organizational cost as a consequence of having like high variability in the, you know, in the kind of programming languages that you choose to use. And so I don't think it's something I don't care about, but I think it's something which is kind of interesting that it's, I think it's something which over the time I've been doing this role, I've gradually kind of learned to let go of things that I would otherwise have previously kind of, you know, thoroughly enjoyed getting involved in. And so you have to kind of step back and say, well, actually, like, I'm not the right person to be making a decision about which technology this team should be using. I should be trusting the team to make that decision. And you have to kind of, you know, I think, as I said, over the time I've been doing the role, I have, you know, you kind of learn which are the decisions that are kind of high consequence that you should be involved in and which are the ones that you have to step back from. And you just have to say, look, I've got, I've got 2 hours of unblocked time this week where I can focus on something. So, you know, which of the things on my priority list, the things that I've written in my journal that I want to get done this month, which of those things am I going to focus on, and which of the other things, you know, kind of leave other people to get on with and trust that things will work out all right.
That's actually a very good segue into my final question, which is the same for everyone. And that is, what is an engineering tool that you can't live without, your favorite?
Oh, that's a good question. So I don't know if this is a cop-out by not mentioning something engineering related, but I think the tool and technique which has helped me the most as I, you know, had more and more management responsibility and trying to keep track of things is bullet journaling. So I think, you know, up until, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago, probably, I'd focus on using either iOS apps or, you know, kind of note tools in, you know, both on my laptop and phone and so on. And they never really stuck. And bullet journaling, you know, through using a pen and a notepad, it forced me to go a bit slower. So it would force me to write things down, to think through what was going on. And there is something about it being physical, which makes me treat it slightly differently. So I think bullet journaling is one of the things which has had the, yeah, it's really helped me deal with keeping track of what's going on and then giving me the ability to then look back over the week, you know, figure out what were the things that frustrated me, what can I change, you know, going into next week. One of the suggestions that it that they recommend, or that the person that came up with bullet journaling recommended, is this idea of like a end of week reflection. And so one of the things I try to do, it's been harder doing it now that I'm working at home, is to spend just 15 minutes at the end of the week thinking of like, what are the things that I'm really proud of? Like, what are some good achievements that I should feel really good about going into next week? And so I think a lot of the activities that stem from bullet journaling have been really helpful. Yeah, it feels like a bit of a cop-out because it's not specifically technology related, but bullet journaling is something which has made a big difference to me.
Not at all. That's totally fair. I think you are the first person who's had like a completely non-technological answer, but I think I've had like a someone answer Slack, something along those lines.
Yeah, I think what's interesting is there are loads of those tools that we use all the time. Like Google Docs is something I can't live without. So I think there's a ton of things that I use day to day that are hard to let go of. But I think the things that have made the most impact on my ability to, you know, to kind of deal with, you know, a stressful job and give you the ability to, you know, to kind of manage yourself a little bit, I think, yeah, it's been one of the most interesting things I've done.
And where could listeners connect with you or follow you?
Cool. So I am at Pingles on Twitter. My DMs are open. So if anybody wants to talk on that, I'm happy to. I'm also on GitHub under Pingles as well. So at Pingles, generally in most places, will get you to me.
Well, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for talking. It's been good fun.
Thanks for listening. I hope you've learned just a little bit more about the business of cloud native. If you'd like to connect with me or learn more about my positioning services, look me up on LinkedIn. I'm Emily Omier. That's O-M-I-E-R. Or visit my website, which is emilyomier.com. Thank you, and until next time.
This has been a Humble Pod production. Stay humble.